One of the great things about Orlando theme parks is that they're always changing. I've lived in Orlando my entire life, and I have watched as the city's biggest tourism draws have tried year after year to reinvent themselves. Whether that's a festival that changes its menu every year, or the introduction of new Halloween events, or in the case of Universal Orlando, the opening of an entire new theme park. In case you were unaware, Universal is opening a fourth gate in the city of Orlando next year. On top of Universal Studios, Islands of Adventure, and their water park, Volcano Bay, they're opening a massive new park called Epic Universe. If you're interested in theme parks at all, as I am, this is a thrilling development, literally, for the city. Disney's Animal Kingdom opened in 1998, Universal's Islands of Adventure opened in 1999, so in my lifetime, a brand new theme park hasn't opened since I was a toddler. Epic Universe is a huge step forward, and theme park journalists are noting that Disney will now be a bit out of step. Despite many new lands opening in the Disney parks here in Orlando, including the Star Wars section that opened a few years ago, a new park for Universal will be a massive draw. Disney has always been changing. That's part of their ethos as a company. But they also rely on their history. And while the four Disney parks have added more and more brand new rides, they also hold on to the classics. For example, Pirates of the Caribbean, Space Mountain, Haunted Mansion, they are iconic Disney rides that have been part of the brand for decades. They remain for a reason, because they're beloved. But as with all things, there's the favorites, and then there are the cult classics, imperfect rides that have remained all these years despite being, let's say, outdated. One is a favorite of mine. It's kind of not great, but that is what holds its charm. If you grew up going to Magic Kingdom, I bet you know the ride that I'm talking about, the one and only Carousel of Progress. In the back of Tomorrowland, tucked next to Space Mountain, is an air-conditioned heaven, a dark, cold room with a simple show telling the story of one family through four eras of American history. As the father of the family sits before us, he tells us as the 20th century changes before him, from the turn of the century to the 20s, then the 40s, then into a sort of hypothetical future, though it really looks more and more outdated every year. But the family explores American culture as technology develops and the American life transforms around them. The characters on stage are not played by actors, of course. They are animatronics that twitch and wiggle in strange ways. The show stays in place and the audience rotates around it, like a carousel. So we move from room to room, through time, seeing these robots play out our own history before us. It's an old attraction, but you never see it really empty. Somehow there's always people in the cozy, cold theater enjoying the strange little story that has played out nearly every day for the last 50 or so years. But what's especially charming about the Carousel of Progress is not the history depicted in the show. It's actually the history of the show that is far more impressive. You see, it is the only ride in Orlando that Walt Disney himself actually worked on. Walt Disney was what is called a futurist. He was obsessed with human technological development, and that is present throughout his theme park development ideas. We've talked about Epcot on this show, not the park, but the prospective city that he wanted to build in Orlando. That's just one example of Disney's fascination with what technology could change in our lives. When Disneyland opened in Anaheim, California in 1955, Disney had a canvas to play out his big ideas. One idea was a show called Harnessing the Lightning, which, quote, featured multiple stages showing American families experiencing new technologies at key points in the past, present, and future, end quote. Does that sound familiar? It would have been a museum rather than a show, and you could sort of walk through and engage with it, but, you know, the idea remained. By the mid-1960s, Disney could finally bring that idea to fruition. He was able to put his show into action thanks to funding from General Electric. They were hosting a pavilion called Progress Land, built for the New York World's Fair, which ran from spring to fall in 1964 and 1965. In fact, the 1964 season opened 60 years ago today, April 22nd, 1964, the New York World's Fair began. This World's Fair is one of the most notable. It was the first of the new baby boomers' generation as they reached adulthood. Many of what was built for the fair still stands in New York, actually the like big globe and those towers. It signified the change of modernity in the post-Kennedy age. and Walt Disney's Carousel of Progress made its debut there. The audio animatronics were an advancement in technology for animatronics and rides, and the rotating theater, quote, enabled over 2,000 people to pass through the show every 4 minutes, end quote. Lines were long and talk was good. Disney had other events at the fair, but the Carousel of Progress was clearly his most successful. After the fair, he adapted the ride and moved it to Disneyland. But when it didn't bring in regular audiences, the Disneyland Carousel closed. But it moved to Walt Disney World in Orlando, where it reopened in 1975 and remains to this day. Though it has changed many times in the last few decades, the Carousel of Progress in Orlando began 60 years ago at the World's Fair in New York. And that fair was far from Florida's first chapter in that legacy. Our connection to the World's Fair is a long history that carries back generations through one of our planet's most fascinating cultural events. Florida has made an impact on the World's Fair. I'm Nick D'Alessandro, and this is Wait 5 Minutes, a podcast about Florida by a Floridian. This week is part one of our two-part spring season finale dedicated to one of my favorite quirks of world history, the fascinating World's Fairs, and the times that these fairs intersected with the state of Florida. Because these fairs were designed to sell the world to itself. The nations were trying to represent themselves to one another, trying to represent culture, technology, entertainment. And Florida wanted the world to come to us, that we always have. That's fundamental to our nature. So, naturally, Florida pulled out all the stops. This week, we're going to go through the origins of the World's Fair and wind up at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893 when Florida made its first real attempt at bringing the nations of the World's Fair to us. I am sure you have heard of the World's Fair before you pressed play on this episode, maybe just in passing. Maybe you're an Orlando native and you've spent a fair bit of time in the strange animatronic presentation around Walt Disney World, where the World's Fair is repeatedly mentioned. It's mentioned also in Epcot at the American Adventure. You know, the World's Fair is a part of Disney's lore, so it's kind of all over. I've always been fascinated about it from there. Maybe you're a true crime fan and you've heard of the infamous serial killer H.H. Holmes, who caused a reign of terror during the Chicago World's Fair. There's a great book about it called Devil in the White City. Check that out because it is an unbelievable story. Maybe you're a movie fan and you've wondered about those weird space age structures that appear in many movies filmed around New York, including Men in Black and Iron Man 2. Maybe you're a native of Indiana and you've always wondered how a famous bit of architecture called the Florida Tropical House could wind up on the shores of Lake Michigan, of all places. I, too, have wondered these things. I myself have been perpetually curious for most of my life. Every little detail of the fairs that I have learned have sparked even more of my interest. What are they? Why don't they exist anymore? How did so many famous events seem to coincide with these fairs? Well, the first thing I needed to unlearn, and I hope I can do you that same favor, is that the World's Fair is not like the Olympics. So think about how the Olympics are every 2 years. There's the Summer Olympics, the Winter Olympics, and those go back and forth, and there's 4 years between every Summer Olympics, etc. And then the Olympics decide what city they're going to go to. The World's Fair wasn't kind of like that. It was sort of like, well, we're going to do it. And then it was like Paris and England arguing over it for the most part. You'll hear about it. But it wasn't quite so organized as that. It really was a thing that changed, especially in the 19th century as it was moved around a lot. The modern Olympics are organized, and they have been for a century. The World's Fair is more like an umbrella term, and a complicated one at that. They go back over 200 years, and the most broad definition is more of an industrial exhibition where one city showcases all of their industry and development to the nations at large and to any nation that attends. So if we're just talking about those, the sort of industrial fairs, there have been hundreds upon hundreds of similar fairs that go back all the way to 1791. But for a century or so, from the mid-1800s to the mid-1900s, the World's Fair was sort of an industrial fair, sort of a cultural celebration, sort of a theme park, all at the same time. That's what we're really talking about. Inventors would showcase their essential innovations, countries would show off their unique artistic stylings, and amusement of all variety would spring up, from early rides to carnival-type attractions. Today, the World's Fair is still around, kind of. It's now what's called an expo, and they've been hosted every 2 years, but they don't quite hold the same draw that they did in that transitional century between the London's Fair in 1851 and the New York Fair in 1965. That 110 years or so, that's really the golden era that we're going to be talking about for these two episodes. In America, we don't really have a need for the World's Fair anymore. We've replaced the fair with actual amusement parks like Disney and Universal. There's entertainment at our fingertips, and the digital age has changed the way innovations are spread. Back in those days, if you wanted to show off like a light bulb, you needed to have everybody go, "Look, that's a light bulb on that stage. Isn't that amazing?" Now you learn about technologies at the touch of a button. It's that easy now. So the World's Fair doesn't really serve a purpose to us anymore. But in 1851, when London held the first quote-unquote official World's Fair, the advancement of industry was just getting started, and nobody knew what the future would hold. Queen Victoria is where it all began. She was the Queen of England from 1837 until 1901. That is a period of astounding change in the United Kingdom. The Victorian era brought about loads of societal change, top to bottom, as the world modernized around her. For a woman born in 1819 and died in 1901, she lived through most of the 19th century, and the England she left behind was much different than the one she inherited. The World's Fair is a centralized reflection of that. Her husband, Prince Albert, paired with a man named Henry Cole, who was a member of England's Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts. England's Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufacturers, and Commerce. Rolls off the tongue. This information comes from a historic UK article by Ben Johnson. There's a link in the description. Go give it a read. Johnson writes that the new society was out to promote the work of English artists, and they were inspired by France's industrial expositions. France had been sort of the pioneers of this whole exhibition business, hosting several of them for decades leading up to 1851. So it had already been a thing, and France was kind of the inventors of it. You know, they get to claim that. Henry Cole and Prince Albert looked to bring the idea to reality of having a fair like that in London. They pitched it as an exhibition for, quote-unquote, all nations. They were able to convince the society to support their plan by making it clear that the whole thing could be self-financed, their own money going back into itself, right? The plan was sent into action, not only to create a great exhibition for international creativity and collaboration, but for England to do it better than anybody ever did it before. You know, England loves to be like, nobody has ever done a World's Fair quite like we did a World's Fair, right? The only problem is they needed a venue, and a big one. There was a gardener from a noble estate in Derbyshire. I do not know how to pronounce that word. The gardener's name was Joseph Paxton. Joseph sought about building a structure out of iron and glass, a huge multi-tiered building known as the Crystal Palace. This quote comes from the Gazette in the United Kingdom. Quote, "The only significant alteration to Paxton's original concept was the inclusion of a barrel-vaulted section tall enough to accommodate three elm trees growing on the site, which would otherwise have had to be felled." End quote. Instead, the giant glass masterwork was built in Hyde Park in the heart of London, with the elm trees safe and sound within the Crystal Palace. The building was made up of, imagine this, 293,000 panes of glass, nearly 2,000 feet long and 108 feet high. This thing was a behemoth, and it was a massive draw. Everything that they wanted it to be, the Crystal Palace was the perfect actualization of their ideas. It was the perfect place to welcome the world in 1851. As Field of Dreams has taught us, if you build it, they will come. And the people of the world showed up. This is from Ben Johnson. Quote, "The exhibits included almost every marvel of the Victorian age, including pottery, porcelain, ironwork, furniture, perfumes, pianos, firearms, fabrics, steam hammers, hydraulic presses, and even the odd house or two." End quote. That's a great list by Ben Johnson. Johnson also notes that though the intention of the exhibition was meant to be a celebration of the world's technological developments, quote, "more than half of the 100,000 exhibits on display were from Britain or the British Empire," end quote. Whoops. It was meant to be everybody, and they were like, oops, all Britain. We just kind of put a bunch of English stuff in here. Anyway, the festival ran from May to October of 1851 and was a resounding success. Quote, 6 million people passed through those crystal doors, end quote. The exhibitions around the world before the 1851 London exhibition were easily shown up by the success of the Crystal Palace and its vendors inside. The palace itself would eventually burn to the ground in 1936, 85 years after it opened. The Crystal Palace was also home to the first dinosaur statues in the world. This is something I discovered just on the side, and we're definitely going to talk about that in the future because Florida has some dinosaur statues as well. Anyway, I would have loved to have seen the Crystal Palace with my own two eyes. It was beloved at the time, but alas, it is gone. The World's Fair was revolutionized that summer in London, and other cities sought to have the next big thing. The next several decades would see more and more advancement to what a World's Fair could be. Paris held the next major fair in 1855, then London had it again in 1862, then Paris took it again in 1867. Vienna finally took the ball away from the French and English sibling rivalry in 1873, and then at last enter the United States of America in 1876. Held in the summer of 1876, the Centennial Exposition was designed to celebrate one century of our young country's existence, held in the city where the Declaration of Independence itself was signed in 1776. It was in Philadelphia. Just as all the others were meant to showcase the host nation and the world at large, this was a huge opportunity for the United States. The Civil War was just over a decade earlier, and America had a reputation to repair during Reconstruction. Photos that exist from the era showcase a hugely vibrant fair with, quote, colossal exhibition halls and more than 200 buildings, end quote. The fair featured a few iconic exhibits and ahead-of-its-time attractions. One was a monorail that actually connected two of the exhibition halls. Another was the future arm of the Statue of Liberty. Yes, the same arm, the one with the torch. It would be put up outside New York City 10 years later in 1886, but in 1876, she was just an arm in Philadelphia, part of their fundraising efforts to bring the full statue to life. The exhibition halls for the Centennial obviously took some inspiration from the Crystal Palace back in 1851. I will post some pictures of the amazing buildings. They are massive and beautiful. There was an agricultural hall and the horticultural hall that was filled with flowers and plants of American nature. There was the machinery hall that showcased new American inventions and technologies, including a steam engine. This fair also featured several prototype telephones that were demonstrated by Alexander Graham Bell himself. There was also a women's pavilion, quote, which promoted more than 80 patented inventions, all produced by women intended to provide them with less housework and more leisure time, end quote. Quite progressive for 1876, you gotta admit that. But there was also attractions outside the gates of the fair. Quote, exhibits not deemed worthy or appropriate for the grounds themselves offered hotel rooms, cheap restaurants, ice cream, and shows of can-can dancers in short skirts and bandeau tops in makeshift wooden structures. End quote. How taboo, ice cream and ladies in skirts. But don't worry, folks, Florida was there. We couldn't possibly have the Centennial Exposition without the Sunshine State making an appearance, but a small one. I dug everywhere to find some reference to Florida in the Centennial Exposition. It was supposed to be a celebration of America, and despite everything, we were a state in 1876. Well, lucky for us, I found some evidence that we were in fact there in the background of a photo of something else. It's a photo showcasing a Smithsonian collection from the fair, a collection of stuffed American mammals, quote, deer, moose, and bison, end quote, the classics. Their description of the photo in the Smithsonian collection includes this sentence, quote, the Florida exhibit is visible in the background, end quote. Indeed, there's a giant sign that says Florida, and there's like a stuffed wolf below the sign. I can't tell if that's the Florida exhibit. I would be a very strange Florida exhibit. We had some wolves, but it's not exactly what we're known for. I think maybe the wolves are in the foreground and then the Florida sign is behind it and the wolves are preventing us from seeing what the Florida sign is over, but that's all I got from 1876. One measly little sign, but hey, we were there. But we finally got a chance to shine just a few short years later in the Windy City itself. Chicago. Before it would make its way back to America, the World's Fair would go back to Paris, then all the way down to Melbourne, Australia, then back to Europe in Barcelona, and then back to Paris. The French could not get enough of this thing. But then, finally, the fair returned to America in 1893, 17 years after the Centennial Exposition. But Florida actually made an appearance at the 1889 Paris Exhibition thanks to funding from railroad executive Henry B. Plant. Plant bought up and built railroads along the Gulf Coast of Florida. He built hotels and basically redefined tourism for the state in his lifetime. We've talked about him before on the show, but Plant was the one who tried to revolutionize the idea of traveling to Florida, then staying in Florida, and then making it a luxury for anyone who came. Plus, it was his whole business. He had the railroads, he owned the hotels, so he was pocketing every penny, right? So where better to advertise the idea of luxury in a beautiful subtropical setting than in a city known for luxury, Paris? There, a presentation was paid for by Plant, held by a man named Arthur Charles Jackson, a somewhat mysterious figure in our state history who did have an impact on Florida's presence at the next World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition in Chicago. So let's go. If you've ever heard of the World's Fair at all, I would bet that you've heard of the Chicago World's Fair. No offense to Paris and their multitude of cracks at a World's Fair, but the Chicago World's Fair is, in my humble opinion, the defining World's Fair of our collective history. It had so much. It had a midway. It had the Ferris wheel. I mean, the World's Fair, please, if you have a chance. I mentioned it earlier. There's a book called Devil in the White City, which is all about the Chicago World's Fair and a serial killer that was active in the World's Fair at the same time. But it's also about the Columbian Exhibition and all of the incredible innovations that were happening in the 1893 fair. It is a very worthwhile read. I mean, you've probably heard of it. It's one of the most famous nonfiction books of the last 20 years. Anyway, Florida at the Columbian Exposition finally got a chance to leave a mark. Congress enacted the plan for the fair to come into existence to honor Christopher Columbus, whose arrival to this part of the world was back in 1492. Though the fair would be held in 1893, it was meant to be a 400-year celebration of that arrival, thus the Columbian Exposition. Each state was meant to contribute to the exposition appointed by governors, with each state being represented by a member of each of the two parties, you know, a Democrat and a Republican. But Orange County actually was the first part of the state to step up and start organizing ways to represent Florida at the fair. Much of what comes next in this episode comes from an article titled Florida and the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893 by Stephen Kerber. There's a link to it on JSTOR. I will include it in the episode description. It is a pretty thorough breakdown of the events and the participants of those events. I really recommend it. Kerber says that the mayor of Orange County at the time, one Willis L. Palmer, arranged the first meeting to discuss how the state would represent itself at the fair. That was in 1891, so we were really planning in advance. Palmer was our 12th mayor here in O-Town, and he is buried in town at Greenwood Cemetery. I can't find much about him. Maybe we'll go check him out in another episode. Anyway, Palmer suggested that the state hold a convention where all the counties could come together to suggest what they would like to see represented at the fair. Governor Francis Fleming, who we've talked about on the show, he himself attended the meeting that would be held on October 7th, 1891, and he rallied the troops. He focused on what needed to be said. Florida was a united front. We had a lot of opportunity here. Come on, check out Florida. Naturally, it wasn't all easygoing as the county delegates were at odds over what to do next. The Farmers Alliance was in attendance, and some folks at the convention called the Farmers Alliance, quote, illiberal and unprogressive, end quote. Two great words, very funny words. Either way, one plan was finally nailed down. The plan was to build, quote, a Florida state building at Chicago modeled on Fort Marion and St. Augustine, end quote. So if you don't know what Fort Marion is, I'm sure you know it by its other name, the Castillo de San Marcos, the incredible historic fort in St. Augustine. At that time, it was known as Fort Marion. Today, we call it the Castillo or the Castillo de San Marcos. I'll use both titles in the episode going forward. One of the leaders in this movement was a man named William Dudley Chipley, a former Confederate soldier and apparent member of the Ku Klux Klan, alongside being a railroad mogul in the Panhandle. Chipley's life is absolutely insane. I have put it on the docket. We will talk about it next spring. He basically made a city rename itself after him. Weird, bad dude. We'll talk about him in another episode of this show. Chipley was putting many things into motion to get the state presence at the fair shored up, including finding the right spot of land in order to build the recreation of our fort in Chicago. The problem was not actually land or even really the idea. We had the land, we had an idea. The problem was money. We did not have any money to build this. There was a donor deadline and the goal was not met, so the money was sent back. Here's a quote, a great long quote from Kerber. Quote, "Despite the enthusiastic efforts of many prominent men and women and the support of several newspaper editors, the public movement for a Florida exhibit at the World's Fair had come to nothing because neither the public, the state legislature, nor the community commissions wanted to pay for it." End quote. Essentially, the plan was dead. But Kerber says, a man who had been perhaps lost to history found his way into this story, and he revived the fort. He is the man Henry Plant hired a few years earlier to promote Florida in Paris, a man who could get the state the money they needed. His name was Arthur Charles Jackson. Kerber's research pulls little to no information about Arthur Jackson, saying, quote, almost nothing has been written about the life of Arthur Charles Jackson, end quote. In the decade and change since Kerber's paper, nothing has really been added. I can't find pretty much anything about the guy outside of this. But Kerber's research indicates that Jackson wound up being integral to the Florida exhibit at the Chicago World's Fair being completed. Quote, Jackson was a promoter, showman, and entrepreneur whose travels took him to many sections of the United States, end quote. He traveled a fair bit. He went to school, he got married, he was a teacher, and of course he worked for Henry Plant in 1889. But it was there with that Henry Plant plan that Florida became essential to his career. Quote, thereafter it appears that Jackson continued to make his living by promoting Florida, end quote. Around the country, he would do presentations of some variety about Florida, including one called Florida Picturesque, which seems like it should be the other way around. Picturesque Florida just sounds better. Anyway, he actually was the one who sold the organizers on the Fort Marion recreation for the fair. It seemed like it was his idea, and he found a way to get it funded, eventually. He suggested, quote, the publication of a gazetteer, which would advertise places, businesses, and opportunities in Florida and would generate the income needed for the construction of the Florida State Building, end quote. I do not know what a gazetteer is or how to say it. There's a gazette, and then this is the same word as gazette, but it's got an extra E and an R, so gazetteer. Anyway, the plan was set into motion, aided by some funding by who else? Henry Flagler, who paid for space in the publication that they would be selling. Quote, his offer to purchase space in the Gazetteer was surely based upon his realization that a prominent Florida exhibit in Chicago might prove of value to his own future interests. End quote. Flagler, ever the good tourism businessman, knew this would be to his benefit. But the funding was not enough, and Jackson, quote, borrowed the money to construct a Florida State Building. End quote. Kerber's research indicates that Henry Flagler himself was the one who advanced the $10,000 that they needed. That fort was going up, no matter what. And up it went. It had a wooden structure with a, quote, coquina veneer to recreate the exterior finish of Fort Marion, end quote. That's fun to imagine, that they built like a wooden structure for the fort and then they like lacquered some outside texture to it. It was 137 square feet and surrounded by exhibits from other states and territories. Plus, if you wanted to go from Florida to Chicago to visit the exhibit, Flagler Plant and another railroad mogul, H.R. Duval, they were offering free rides on their rail lines to visit the recreation fort in person. After years of work from Florida and the nation and all the nations at large, the Columbian Exposition finally began in May of 1893. All told, it seems like the fort was a success for the state, though the lack of other exhibits about Florida was noted by eyewitnesses at the time. It seemed like all of our resources went to the recreation of the Castillo de San Marcos. A quote from the time that Kerber noted says, quote, "It attracts universal attention and is concluded to be one of the most interesting and attractive buildings on the grounds," end quote. Indeed, there are photos that exist of the fort recreation, and it looks fantastic, honestly. It's got all the little details of it, you know, there's like that lip on the top and then the parapets and the corners. It looks fantastic, but it is, of course, hilariously a bit smaller. You know how like the fort is quite tall when you're next to it? This one's like maybe a few feet above your head. It's quite charming. In terms of showcasing perhaps our most iconic piece of architecture, it was a success. It was noted in comparison to other state buildings as being very unique. It stood out from the crowd. But I must reiterate, we were kind of nowhere else at the fair. An eyewitness from the time noted that we didn't contribute to like the horticultural exhibition or whatever. We didn't have like a flower exhibit or a showcase of our crops and agriculture. We wanted to build our fort, damn it, and that's what we did. That was our focus. That's not to say that there weren't plants or flowers around the exhibit. Another source I found says that the interior of the fort had, quote, bamboo, orange, lemon, and other tropical trees, end quote. There were also miniature recreations of farms, which is a bizarre visual. Maybe not very small, but like, you know, reenactments of people farming. I don't know. It just wasn't what it should have been, because there was agricultural and horticultural exhibits that other states contributed to go like, look, these are the plants and stuff that we grow. You know, these are the crops that you can get from Montana. But it seems that Florida just didn't do that. We just were like, we're building Fort Marion. Isn't that enough? Isn't that what you guys want? But that's because there was this constant infighting with the people who were organizing the event for Florida, the people who were bringing it to existence. There was constant bickering over what to do, where the money was coming from, who was involved. You know, Arthur Jackson was actually ousted from his position because of this infighting. There was some like controversy about what he did to get it done, how he got the money. It was nonsense. And though the fort itself was a success, with thousands passing through the exhibit every day, those involved in organizing were left with a bitter taste when all was said and done. 19th century rich people could be petty. Kerber's analysis indicates that the exposition may not have been an overall very fruitful event for the state, saying it doesn't seem to have drawn a substantial increase in tourism at that time. Also, because of the lack of industry insights, like investing in business technology or agriculture, the economy didn't exactly gain a ton of investment from the fair. Florida didn't kind of do the thing that you were supposed to do, except having a big show-off-y recreation of an important piece of architecture. Kerber notes that the conflicts of corporate power around the fair, that was really just an appetizer for the insane corporate chaos to follow as the 20th century loomed on the horizon. As for the fort, its end is a tragic and unusual one. You see, the Columbian Exposition ended abruptly and in a bit of a dark manner when the mayor of Chicago, Carter Henry Harrison, was murdered on October 28th, two nights before the fair was supposed to officially close. This essentially ended Chicago's attempt to bring the fair back the next year in 1894. That winter, quote, "poor people, vagrants, and tramps occupied the vacant fair buildings," end quote. Some buildings were saved or moved, including the Midway, which was moved to Coney Island. Some buildings burned down in a pair of fires in 1894. Others were disassembled by a team that took years to finish. They didn't finish taking it all down until 1896. And for the purposes of this show, Kerber says, quote, "the fate of the Florida building is unknown," end quote. Maybe a fire, maybe it got torn apart, lost to history. A bit of an unceremonious ending for the fair and for our little fort. But it was not the end of our state's forays into the fairs. No, no. In the 20th century, the World's Fair would return, and Florida would return with it. And we'd bring along big pink buildings, groves of citrus trees, a talking statue of Ponce de Leon, and what else but gator wrestling. All that and more in part two of our World's Fair exploration next Monday. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Wait 5 Minutes. I am so glad that you are here. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps the show grow, and it means a lot to me to know what you enjoy about the show. You can also find the show on Instagram and Facebook at WFMPod, and you can send me an email at WFMPod@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you. If there's anything about the World's Fair you find particularly interesting, because I know there's lots of weird little quirks that I am just breezing past as I focus in on one specific thing. If there's anything about the World's Fair that you love, send it along, wfmpod@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you. I'll also be posting pictures from all of these incredible archives, including that little sign that I found for the 1876 World's Fair, the picture of the recreation of Fort Marion, all that I'll be posting on the Instagram. I will also be including some links that I used in the research in the episode description, so you can go check those out, especially Stephen Kerber's incredible piece about Florida at the Chicago World's Fair, a really great read. Go check that out. All of the music was originally composed. All right, folks, we will be back next week for our final episode in the spring. I cannot believe how fast this spring has gone. So many stories we've gotten to tell together, but this is our last one until the summer. That will be on April 29th. It will be our second episode about the World's Fair, and boy, there is so much to unpack in that episode. Until then, be good to yourself, be good to others, drink more water, and go Gator and muddy the water. Have a great week. I will see you next Monday.